Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here on Breadbox Media this time every day, Monday through Friday, talking about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And it being Monday, we're here today with my good friend, Simca Fisher. Simca is, she's a blogger for the National Catholic Register. You write for Alatea sometimes, right?
Alatea. I write for Alatea all the time, 5 times a week, if not more.
Alatea,
I can't believe I never thought of that.
Really? Yeah, it's just the first thing that popped into my head. Alatea is one in a long line of religious websites with difficult to pronounce names of confusing spelling. And I think Alatea, is that like Greek for truth or something like that? I think
it is. When I actually took a couple of years of Greek in college, and we pronounced it Alatea. Yeah, but I don't know if that was right. I remember there was something about these little accent marks that were sprinkled around. They were really important. The accent marks are really, really important, and I never got the hang of them. But I don't know. So that's all I know. I'm just adding to the confusion, I guess.
Okay.
Trying to look smart in the process. Okay.
There was
it does mean truth, though. I do know that. It definitely does mean truth. So we've got that going for us.
The hero, one of the heroes in, what am I thinking of? The Last Battle is named for the Hebrew word for truth. He's one of the Calarmenes. He's like this noble Calarmene who has only wanted to go and...
He's like the noble pagan who didn't realize he was serving as...
Or
something. And, name? I didn't really remember he had a name.
His name was the Hebrew word for truth, which eludes me at the moment.
Huh.
A very conscious choice by Lewis, of course, to name him that.
Yeah.
Now that's going to be like bugging me all through the...
Wait,
you were supposed to save me here. Okay.
I'm looking it up right now. Hold on a second.
You can look it up for me.
Too fat. I spelled color.
Okay.
MF.
That was it. It was MF. EMETH.
Oh. Yep.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Ethan Bolin, our researcher extraordinaire. He goes out and finds these things for us. So, yes, Emeth is the Hebrew word for truth. And so Lewis names this this great pagan warrior who has worshipped, or so he thought, has worshipped the evil god Tash all of his life. But what he was really seeking was Aslan. So... which is, I could, if I chose at this point, I could take this, into one of those endless do Muslims and Christians worship the same God questions. But we've been through this before, I think, perhaps 1,000 times in one way or another.
Probably.
And so I'll just say, yes, they do, because that's what the church teaches. And if you don't think that, then you're wrong. But... I won't do that. Far be it from me to actually do that. I will not do that.
No. Well, that's a relief. I'm glad we really dodged a bullet there.
Okay, good. And a lot of my answers to questions like that are, well, what does the church teach? Okay,
then that's, I know. It's almost that's like that's the what the case, church is for.
Yeah, it's like that's what the church is for. I had somebody very patiently explain to me that, the magisterium has been right about a lot of things, but here, strangely, where the magisterium has disagreed with me, that's just where the magisterium turns out to be wrong, It's like, How about that?
Yeah. You gotta give them credit for at least acknowledging that that's what they're doing. Because I mean, when I look back over the way I behave most of the time and the things that I say and the things that I do act as if the magisterium doesn't know very well about certain things. You know?
At least they
have the honesty to say the magisterium is wrong, rather than me saying, "Oh yes, the magisterium is right." And now I'm going to just go ahead and do whatever I want because it's easy.
I find it much easier to do that. The whole easier to get forgiveness and permission thing, you know. Yeah. Sure, I agree with the magisterium all the time. I'm just not doing what it says to do right now because I'm going to go to confession later.
Yeah, I told my kids.
We do that.
If you do it consciously, that is actually a whole other, what's it called? Presumption. It's the sin of presumption, right?
Yes, it's a whole other thing.
If you do something deliberately, well, and that makes sense. You know, it's something interesting I've been thinking about. When I was younger, there were a lot of sins which seemed so, like, unfair that they should be sins, and they seemed so nitpicky and everything. And I realized that a lot of the time, like, for instance, it used to seem so unfair to me that I could only understand that what you do with your body could be sinful. And I'm not talking about, like, sexual sins, but just, like, anything that you do with your body. You know, kill somebody or hit somebody or steal something. But if you do something with your will or with your mind, that can also be a sin, even a serious sin. And that seems just unbearable to me. I thought that was just ridiculous. I'm talking about when I was, like, 12 or something. And then I realized what it comes down to is that the church and Jesus and God the Father take us very seriously, and they give us the respect, if that's not the wrong word, you know, they take us seriously enough to say that, you know, your mind is something very important, and what you do with your mind is just as important as what you do with your body. So of course you can sin with your mind. You know, it's not that the church is, like, invading your privacy or something like that. It's that the church takes you seriously to the core, even if you don't take yourself that seriously.
Yes.
That's what a lot of the baffling sins come down to, is that the church takes us more seriously than we take ourselves, and values our souls more than we value them ourselves. That's, I don't know, something to think about.
Yeah, no, I think it's true, and it's certainly how Jesus talks in the Sermon on the Mount. You know, the Sermon on the Mount, in a lot of ways, is a commentary on the Ten Commandments. And so what the Ten Commandments do is they compose the floor of Christian morality. It looks like we may have lost Simca. I'm not sure. But at any rate, the Ten Commandments are the floor of Jewish and Christian morality. And so they say things, they give you a kind of a silhouette of Jesus. They give you an outline of Jesus rather than a portrait of Jesus. And so a lot of them are cast in negative terms. So you shall have no other gods before me. Do not steal. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. And all of these... Ethan, are you there? Am I the one that just got cut off? Or is it... I'm good. Okay. So that's what the Ten Commandments do. And then the last two commandments are very interesting because they're commandments that no earthly authority could possibly enforce. If you kill somebody, the police can come and take you away for that. If you steal something, they can come take you away for that. In times gone by, if you committed adultery, the cops could come and take you away for that. And these were public sins that you could see were being committed. But the last two commandments are against things that no earthly authority can enforce. They're against coveting your neighbor's stuff and coveting your neighbor's wife, or your neighbor's husband, in many cases as well. And there's already a commandment against stealing, and there's already a commandment against adultery. So what's the point of those last two commandments? Well, they're directing you to the real source of all sin. And this is what Jesus does too. So he expands on that idea in the Sermon on the Mount and says, "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall not kill.' But I say to you, if you hate somebody from your heart, you've already killed them." Because that's where murder begins. Murder doesn't begin in the hand. It doesn't begin in the weapon that you use. It begins in the heart. It starts there with the choice to hate, and then to kill. And adultery is the same way. Adultery begins in the heart, and it begins with the choice to relish the act of lust, and particularly the lust for one's neighbor's spouse, or the refusal of love to your own spouse in preference to, you know, whatever it is or whoever it is you choose. And that's, you know, that's all leading, of course, into what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about Lent and what's the purpose of Lent? Why do we do this thing? Why do we spend 40 days out in the desert denying ourselves, taking up our cross and following Jesus? This is something that our culture tends to regard as, you know, it's negative. But really what it is, of course, is it's about foregoing earthly pleasures for the sake of growing in our relationship with Jesus. I really like Lent, and so I'm looking forward to having that conversation. When we get Simca back, I'm sure she'll turn up safe and sound. I don't think that she's gone forever, but we'll be back talking about that. Just had a weird thing happen with the sound there, Ethan. I'm not sure what's happening. But we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back talking about Lent right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Oh, my stars and garters, welcome back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Simca Fisher.
I'm making Mark laugh.
Speaking to us from Termite Terrace. That's so great.
And, shall I tell everybody?
Tell the story.
I'm getting my mail this morning. We go out. I mean, the kid, one of the kids is homesick, so she goes out and gets the mail for me. And there's this letter that's hand addressed, and it's anonymous. And I'm like, oh, that's never good. That's never a good thing when it's handwritten and anonymous. So I open it up, and it says, "You must have noticed the increase in renewal and repairs done to residences in the town." And it's like, you know, we've done this and we've done that and everything. And it's like, you know, your house and your property could actually, you know, when you think about it, you know, a little bit of paint and maybe not so much garbage and listing all these things that you can do. And it's like, and then it points out at the end that most of these things can be achieved with a small amount of money and just some hard work. Oh, you know what? It's just like, that is not the right way to get me to do something, I'll tell you.
Not cool, man.
Not cool, man. As I was saying, we have a mere two appliances. We have an armchair and we have a dishwasher in our front yard right now, and that is it. That's all. I think that's like anything under five dishwashers and armchairs.
I'm,
it's like
I'm moving out of the United States.
You know, I just, if you can't live in New Hampshire and have dishwashers in your front lawn, I don't know what is the point of living here. That's the only reason, one of the few reasons to live in New Hampshire is because, you know, live free or die with dishwashers in your yard.
I thought that was the Vermont.
No. Vermont is for weenies. Are you kidding? What do you?
I thought that was their slogan, live free or die.
It's New Hampshire's slogan.
Is that New Hampshire? Oh, okay.
It is. It was Patrick.
Always sounds like a threat.
Well, it could be construed that way.
Live free or die.
Yeah. No, it's implied. I would rather, you know what? You get it. Don't pretend you don't get it. Vermont's slogan is the Green Mountain State.
Is it? Is okay.
It's like, yes, how interesting. You have a mountain which is green in your state. It's like,
Vermont. That's very different from Washington.
Yeah, I know.
Our mountains are white.
Well, we also have the White Mountains here. It's the mountains did not get a lot of interest. We have the Green Mountains. We have the White Mountains.
Wasn't that like some children's novel where the totalitarian state was going around putting metal caps on people's heads to make them think correct things or something? I have this vague memory of something like that. With a title like The White Mountains. You can tell that I'm really on top of that.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's all, I know 9 out of 10 novels written nowadays are about the totalitarian state going around putting something on your head or, you know, something on some part of your body.
That's right. You know, I think there's a whole conversation to be had at some future date about the rise of the dystopian child novel where children are constantly being sent the message that we adults hate you and we want to kill you. And better still, we'd like to set you at each other's throats so that you're forced to kill each other.
Well, here's the question, though. I mean, I don't like, you know, when I see my kids reading those, I'm like, oh, come on, enough already. It's ridiculous. No wonder they're all depressed all the time. But I think what was in vogue when I was growing up, when they were writing, you know, young adult novels, when I was, in fact, a young adult, and it was all, it was suicide, anorexia, bulimia, and the Holocaust. And that was pretty much it. Just like wall-to-wall anorexia and the Holocaust. That's how I remember it anyway. I mean, those were really very, very popular. I think it's just, I don't know. I mean, you could definitely read larger societal, you know, figure out what the zeitgeist is or something, but mainly they just know that kids like to feel mopey and they have to latch on to the latest mopey thing that kids can feel mopey about. And the dystopian stuff is fun because you can make stuff up. You don't have to do any kind of research. You don't have to do any kind of historical research or, you know, scientific anything. You just, you know, the weirder the better. So I don't know. I think it's tiresome myself. I get very, very tired of it. And the other thing is that nobody just writes a single book anymore. Everything has to be like a trilogy is like what you do. You start with a trilogy. Like that's like the starter kit. Everything has to be at least, you know, 5 novels, 8 novels, 14 novels. I think they must be written by machines or they're written by a room full of monkeys.
I blame Tolkien for all of that. you know, even though, I mean, Tolkien didn't actually write a trilogy. What happened was Tolkien published The Lord of the Rings in 1954 when the British economy was still in recovery from World War II.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't afford to publish The Lord of the Rings as this big, fat single volume tome that he'd actually written.
Oh, so they really? Broke it into
yeah.
Oh my God,
so that's how it got
that.
Broken up. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a long book. Holy mackerel.
Yeah, it was a long book. Well, it's hilarious. I mean, Sir Stanley Unwin goes to Tolkien in 1937 after he publishes The Hobbit and says, could you write like another Hobbit book? And he says, okay, I'll get on that. And then like 14 years later, With an entire World War II in between, he walks into Sir Stanley Edwin's office and lays down this 1,000-page manuscript and says, okay, I wrote your book that you wanted back in 1937. And they're like, okay, why didn't you just do what I told you to do? You know? But and then there was like the big struggles afterwards, you know, because the copywriter and the proofreader, you know, like went through and changed like dwarves to dwarfs and elves to elves, which Tolkien would have none of this. And you just don't go around changing Tolkien's prose like that.
You could tell he thought about every syllable in it.
Oh yeah, he did.
I'm reading The Hobbit out loud to the kids now. Some of them haven't read it yet, and the older ones still enjoy it enough that they don't mind hearing it read out loud again. And I remembered what a good story it was, but I've forgotten how great the writing is. It's fantastic. It's so, you know, if you just listen, it's something that really ought to be read aloud, because when you hear the sound of the description, somehow they're so evocative when the way he describes scenes and the way he describes the action. It's very, very visual. It's amazing. Just I'm just blown away. And the kids are impatient because I just sit there with my mouth hanging open. Like, did you guys hear that? I'm gonna read that again. They're like,
it was really good.
Just they want to know what happened with the spider. Don't read it again. Oh, they're really enjoying it though. This is a good one.
That's good.
I'm so happy. Go ahead.
Oh, you're gonna say something.
I'm happy. Are you happy? I was going to say I'm happy to be back to reading out loud to the kids. Oh, you know what? I know what it was. It's because I was pregnant and I couldn't stay awake in the evening. That's why. But I'm not pregnant now, so I'm seizing the opportunity to read some books out loud to the kids. We're reading The Hobbit, and then the teenagers. I have four teenagers, and we're reading Out of the Silent Planet to them. Actually, not just to the teenagers, to the kids who are like 9 and up, I guess, which is stretching it a little bit for the younger kids, but they're enjoying it. So it's not, I know this is heresy, but C.S. Lewis is, some of his sentences, like, he really needed an editor for some of this stuff. It's so convoluted. I had forgotten how convoluted he gets sometimes. Like, man, just say what you mean. Come on. I don't know. I'm spoiled by Tolkien. Tolkien was such a poet, you know. And Lewis, when he's writing his nonfiction, he has such an incredible clarity. And I love C.S. Lewis. I love C.S. Lewis. You know what my favorite book by him is? Till We Have Faces, which I don't understand why it doesn't get more. To me, it's a masterpiece.
They should make a film of it.
It's fantastic. Well, yeah, I can see that if the right person did it. Not, what's his name? Jackson. What's his name? You know, he'd split it into three. Peter Jackson, yeah. Can you imagine? And there would be like an extra love interest, and they would be, like, you know, puppets or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. I know it's mystified me that nobody has done anything with that story. It's a great story. There it is. If you're listening out there in Radio Land, and you have strong views about any of these things, by all means, feel free to give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And we're wending our way toward talking about Lent a little bit today. That's the big thing this week, is the beginning of Lent. So we got that starting on Ash Wednesday. So we're in the last like couple of wind down days. We had our Mardi Gras party on Saturday. I don't know why they call it Mardi Gras, which means Fat Tuesday, on Saturday, but that's what we did. And we also, this is at our parish, and we also had like gobs of jambalaya and or jambalaya, if you want to get really technical. And just had a great time, and live music and the whole thing. But it's all heading toward Ash Wednesday. We'll be back talking about Lent and Ash Wednesday and all of those things with Simca Fisher here on Connecting the Dots on Redbox Media. We'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sipka Fisher, and we're talking about getting ready for Lent. It's just around the corner, two more days. It's Ash Wednesday, and the excitement begins, the thing that is Ash Wednesday. And so I think it's worth talking a little bit about what Ash Wednesday and the attraction of Ash Wednesday and Lent. It's interesting. A lot of people either don't know or don't care that Ash Wednesday is, for example, it's not a holy day of obligation, but it has a huge turnout. People pour into churches for Ash Wednesday. And I think that that's significant because the church doesn't demand that you do that. It's just something that people really feel a strong instinct to go do. And I've always found that fascinating, and I think it's part of it is the attraction, and there is an attraction, to being placed face-to-face with your own mortality. That what Ash Wednesday does, in a certain sense, stronger than, for example, All Saints or All Souls does, or the whole month of November, which is devoted to, among other things, thinking about the fact that you're going to die. That's what Ash Wednesday does. They put ashes on you and say, "Remember, O man, that you are dust, and to dust you will return." And in a culture that spends all of its time running away from death, on Ash Wednesday, it runs right toward it and feels this need to be reminded of our mortality. And I think that that's great. I remember hearing Garrison Keillor one time told a story about how he was at a funeral somewhere. And as the funeral concluded, the minister who was celebrating the funeral said, offered a prayer and prayed for the next person among us who will die. And he said all the people that were at this thing were just so offended by that. And he thought it was fantastic. He thought it was really, because, you know, being a good sort of gloomy, Midwest,
Right.
Lutheran type, I mean, that's really what it is. What is Christianity ultimately about? Well, it's about preparation for death. That's what we're doing, when we're doing all this. We're getting ready to make our way to our own Calvary sooner or later. For some of us, it's going to be sooner, and for any of us, it might be before I finish this sentence. That's just how life is. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. And I like that about Ash Wednesday. Ash Wednesday reminds us of what life is about. And that's what Lent is doing, too. It's saying, sooner or later, all these toys and all of this stuff and all these hobbies and activities and everything else that you're filling your life up with, they're all going to go away. And it's just going to be you face to face with the Grim Reaper. And what are you going to do then? Well, Lent gives us a chance to think about what we'll do then, so we don't have to think about it then.
Right.
It's the same reason that I love formulaic prayers.
Right,
I really like formulaic prayers, because formulaic prayers are prayers you don't have to, like, be clever.
Right.
And think them up, right. In the spur of a moment.
You know you're covered, yep.
Yeah. And so formulaic prayers are... That really works for me. It says everything that I need to say. And helps me say it better than I would be able to say it myself if it were just suddenly all on me to think of something brilliant to say right. when the guy has just come and knocked at your door to inform you that your wife was just killed in a car accident or whatever, you know.
Right.
Lent. I'm a big fan of Lent. So do you... I can only guess that Lent can be a bit of a challenge, or that Ash Wednesday can be a bit of a challenge for you when you've got a big family.
Yeah, it's not so much having a big family. It's the fact that there, when we were homeschooling, it was no problem because we could just, you know, go to the 12 o'clock mass or whatever and build the day around it. But now that we've got all driving around like crazy people and recurring appointments and drama club and Shakespeare club and all this stuff, we do end up schlepping. And plus, we don't have a church in our town. We have to drive into the next town because our town is too small. They have a Catholic church here, but it's empty, unfortunately. There's not enough people going there. So it does mean everybody piling into the van at 7 o'clock at night. But mm-hmm. I don't know. The kids were saying, is it a holy day of obligation? Like, look, we can manage at the beginning of Lent to get out and get to the church one time at the beginning of Lent. I think we can do this. And then, you know, and then when you do it at the end of the day, you're spared the, you know, which, what to a middle school kid could be the excruciating pain of having to walk around with ashes on your forehead all day. You know, I think some people definitely enjoy it, but at a certain age, that's a lot to ask of a person.
Yeah.
So they just have to have it on for an hour or so until they go to bed. So I don't know.
Yeah.
As of now, I'm definitely planning to go. But, oh, and the other thing is Damien works. My husband works late, so it's usually me dragging the kids. But, you know, I've got teenagers, and they do a lot with the younger kids and everything. So not nearly as hard as it used to be when they were all young. That was murder. Murder, I tell you.
Yeah. It's gotten easier for us. It's, you know, we just go and...
yeah, I know.
The guys get in the car.
Where are your shoes? Where are your shoes? I know you have shoes. get there. Actually, yesterday? Yeah, yesterday we were at Mass and I turned around and my daughter has this horrified, mortified look on her face and she's all hunched up and squinched over and I'm like, what the heck? And I suddenly realized her... watch, she's decided to wear her watch, her Frozen watch, you know, from the movie Frozen, and it's singing let it go. She was wearing it, she pressed the button by mistake. Next time we'll be much more careful not to press the button. I'm like, Sophia, next time don't wear the Frozen watch. You don't need to wear
it. Wear the Frozen watch.
So that's
sage advice.
Yep, that's what my years of experience have taught you.
My big plan this week is I want to have like a conversation with the fam about like what are we actually going to do for Lent? I mean, you know, and how can we support each other and what things might we be praying for in the prayer part of our prayer, fasting and almsgiving, and you know, what are we fasting for and
right.
Those kinds of things. Meant to have that conversation last night, but you know, yesterday I was just exhausted all day. I hadn't slept at all Friday
got
night.
Back? Didn't you just get back from a trip? You just got back?
No. I couldn't sleep Friday night for one. You know, have you ever had those nights where you just are up all night, just don't sleep?
I always have those nights.
Okay, yeah. So I had one of those nights. So I finally got to bed at like 6:30 in the morning, 7:30 in the morning, and so I slept until noon. So about 4.5 hours. And then got up and hurried off to go because I was Knights of Columbus guy, so helping out with the Mardi Gras party.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So did that for like 6 hours. So by the time I got home, I was just dead. And so I went to bed Saturday night and I slept. But, you know, it was one of those sleeps where you sleep all night and then you get up in the morning and you're like, I'm awake for about a half an hour and then you're exhausted again. Well, I'd already been to Mass Saturday night, but while we were standing around waiting for the party to begin, I thought, oh, I'm going to Mass now. So I did. So I didn't go to Mass Sunday morning because I'd been to the vigil. And so the whole day, I just was like dragging around all day thinking, you should take a nap, but then not ever doing that for some reason.
I know. Why is that so hard?
Yeah.
I need an adult to put me to bed, tell me what to do.
Yeah. So eventually, you know, I was like, okay, it's the evening. And then my son, who was going to be, we were going to have the family conversation, all that. He goes off somewhere to go hang out with friends because it's Super Bowl Sunday. So I waited around for him to come back. And by the time he got back, I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to bed again. So so I went to bed. And so we never did have our big Lenten conversation about things.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm thinking, maybe we'll try that tonight. And so now I'm just hoping that he's not going to go off somewhere and be gone again. And we never had a conversation. But
yeah.
So anyway.
I'm trying to think. We do some stuff together as a family. I've repeatedly told the kids, and my husband has repeatedly told the kids, Ash Wednesday is coming. You need to have a plan before. I don't want you thinking, trying to figure out what to do on Wednesday. And no, you can't give up going to school, and you can't give up Spanish class. They all hate Spanish class for some reason. I had a great uncle who used to give up parsley and elephant rides. That was his big joke. Well, of course, he was Jewish, so that was why, you know, Ash Wednesday. I don't even know why he had to come up with an Ash Wednesday joke being a Jew in Brooklyn, but that was the standard line. He was going to give up parsley and elephant rides for Lent. So we try to avoid that kind of thing. We try to avoid things that are going to make other people suffer. I remember one year my father gave up drinking coffee. And my mother begged him, please, please start drinking coffee.
Well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back with Simca Fisher and Lent right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Simca Fisher, or we will be here with Simca Fisher when we can get her back. We're having a few technical difficulties. We've been talking a bit about Lent. Lent is, it's interesting. Lent takes its name from, it's just the old English word for spring. One of the things you often find, especially in Germanic languages, is that the name that sticks to the church season comes from whatever the Germans German speaking language group people happen to be doing at that time. Hey, Simca, welcome back.
Hey.
The season of Lent just takes its name from the old English word for spring. And in the same way, Easter got its name in the Germanic language groups because there was a feast at the time to a goddess named Estra. And so we just kept the name. And we did the same thing with our days of the week. Mm-hmm. So all of the days of the week are all named for pagan or Roman gods. So Monday and Tuesday and
What's Tuesday? What does that mean?
No,
you just said Tuesday in a funny voice. You just said
T E W E S was the name of the goddess. The Norse goddess whose name happens to
really?
Be attached to that. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I accused you of just talking in a funny voice. I honestly thought that's what you were doing and hoping no one would notice.
I never talk in a funny voice. And Woden's Day, Thor's Day, Freya's Day, and then you get Saturn in there for some reason, a Roman holdover. And so, you know, one of the dumber arguments that people often make is that, you know, Easter is a warmed over pagan holiday because Easter. And it's like, seriously? I mean, you know, so am I worshiping a pagan god because I said today is Monday? Do you think I'm a moon worshiper because of that? No, it's just, you know, how the linguistic cookie crumbled, you know? And, of course, the moment you get away from Anglo-Saxon roots in language, you find that you know, most of the world refers to Easter by some variation of Passover.
That's true. Pasca, right? In Italian and French, like most of the Romance languages.
All the Romance languages. Yeah, yeah. And it goes well beyond that, you know, into other language groups as well.
Uh-huh.
So the whole notion that, you know, Easter is somehow pagan because Easter is like, well, come on, you know.
It's the English language. It's designed to be misleading and confusing.
Well, yeah, yeah. And the same thing, you know, days of the week, you know, sometimes in Romance languages, Sunday is just called the Lord's Day in some variation, you know, and it's not named after the sun. It's one of those things where we're kind of prisoners of the extreme ascendancy of English. Mm-hmm. You know, languages become dominant languages because the people who speak them are the military and economic powers in the land. So, you know, when Rome is ascendant, well, everybody speaks Latin because if you want to get along in life, you're going to need to know some Latin, you know. And now if you want to get along in life, you need to know English. And eventually, if you need to get along in life, you're going to have to know Chinese. But,
I guess so. I don't know. That seemed true a while ago. I don't think that's so true anymore. Although my kids are all taking Chinese. All three of my kids are taking Mandarin in high school. They I think I talked about this before, and they know how to like order food and talk about pop music now.
Well, you know, that's important.
Something. It's definitely
plus they can follow, you know, bits of dialogue if they're ever watching Serenity or Firefly, and that's important too.
Right.
But well, yeah, it's funny. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I sometimes wonder about, by 2035, China is going to be the most Christian nation on planet Earth.
Huh.
And one of the things that the gospel often seems to take with it is an enormous amount of fruitfulness and fertility in other ways. So kind of as a byproduct of having become Christian, Europe cooked up things like the scientific method, which has worked out well for Europe. I sometimes wonder if as China becomes increasingly Christian, if the gospel is going to toss off these happy byproducts for China as well. Exert its civilizing influence, and therefore at least historically has tended to be a prosperity producing influence. I don't know if that's really going to be the case. The gospel has no promise contained in it that that's the case.
No.
It just seems to have worked out that way for Europe. But of course, part of the reason that it worked out that way for Europe is because Europe also became an exploitative colonializing power that got rich off of stealing a lot of other people's stuff sometimes. But anyway, it's just speaking of Lent, it's an interesting question because part of what Lent does is it challenges us on our relationship with money.
Mm-hmm.
By demanding almsgiving. And this, of course, comes out of the Jewish tradition. Prayer, fasting, and almsgiving Jesus didn't invent those. He just reaffirms them as traditional forms of piety that were already commonplace in Judaism. The almsgiving thing is always hard for me. I think it's hard for everybody. I want to be generous, but on the other hand, I don't want to be generous because it means I don't have enough. I don't get as much stuff, you know.
Well, yeah, you know what? I'll tell you what. Part of the reason that I struggle with it is because we've been so. I think a lot of people. I can't be the only ones. Just have sort of a weird relationship with money in general, and it's hard to know. It's all mixed in with all kinds of psychology, and you know, it's not just about greed. It's about all kinds of things. You know, I think we kind of sell ourselves short if we say, well, the only reason I'm having trouble with this is because I'm greedy and I want more stuff to myself. You know, I'm sure, right. You know, obviously that is definitely a part of it. But, well, like you said, I mean, like exploring our relationship with money or giving a hard look to, or I was listening, but I forget what you said, taking a hard look at your relationship with money and figuring out which parts are not as healthy as they could be, you know. Because
for me, a lot of it comes down to fear. We live on a financial knife edge.
Right.
Something I'm sure you can relate to as well. And so it's like, you know, yes, I would like to be generous. But on the other hand, I really don't know if I'm going to be able to make the bills. And, you know, tax time is coming up in March. Right. And, we got to pay off the school loan. And, you know, yikes.
Especially when you're responsible for other people. I mean, it's not just a matter of saying, well, I can live on beans and rice, or I don't mind living in a drafty apartment. You know, you're responsible for your family and everything. So I know. I mean, it's... In one way, being a Catholic is like the most reasonable, moderate thing that you can be, because we're a both-end people. You know, we're always trying to strike that fine line. But on the other, and at the same time, by the same token, it's an extremely difficult line to walk, because you don't want to be greedy. You don't want to be selfish. You want to be generous, but you don't want to be imprudent, and you don't want to. Right. Also, I sometimes see people talking about tithing as if it's almost as if it's a very savvy kind of financial technique that you can do involving God. You know what I mean?
Like, I know. Well, that's so weird.
Isn't that weird? Like, what? When does God ever do stuff like that? Ever? You know, if you tithe, I guarantee you that, you know, within 5 years you will see greater financial stability than you have ever in your life, and it will be paid back to you tenfold. And that means this actual X amount of dollars.
I know. I just
not true, actually.
What? Well, you know, I thought about writing an article one time about Jesus Christ financial counselor.
Yeah.
Because all the stuff that he says is just like at direct odds to so much of what I hear from, you know. So you should always invest, you know, so as to get a return, right? What does Jesus say, right? Be sure that you give money to people who will never ever be able to repay you, you know. And, you know, when you have a party, don't invite, you know, other people who are going to be able to pay you back. Instead, invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, people who will never be able to repay you. It's like, this is just so directly counter to all the stuff that you hear about being a smart investor and all of that stuff, you know. So I'm skeptical about that whole end of things.
Yeah, I think it is true in a very broad sense that when you are generous, God will be generous with you. Yeah. But his idea of generosity is not always what we're expecting, or necessarily what we would have hoped for, necessarily in the short term, at least. So it's not a financial strategy. And if you're going to have to, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, this is exactly why Lent is presented to us, is to force us to think about these things.
Yep.
Simca Fisher, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. Our producer today was Ethan Bolin. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and I will be back tomorrow with Tom McDonald. Till then, see you later. Bye.